You're listening to Builderpedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Okay, welcome to the latest episode of Builderpedia. Joining us today is friend of Builderpedia, Melissa Naber from Sky Planning. Welcome, Mel. How are you going?
I'm good. Thank you, Matt. It's great to be here. Great to be back on the podcast.
Yeah, and got some very exciting news. We're in our own podcast studio of sorts. We're working on it. I've got some chairs in the background. One day I hope to have you here. So welcome.
Thank you.
So what's news? What's been happening?
Yeah, good question. There's a lot happening on all fronts. Certainly, I'm always feel like I want to say a bit of a planning revolution, really.
Planning revolution.
Yeah. Well, look, planning's certainly having a day in the sun at the moment with all of the changes coming from the state to try and drive density in our existing urban areas and improve housing supply.
Yeah. Or if you're on the flip side of that, it's a Labor government and developer conspiracy to disrupt something or other.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, that confusion, I think, happens in people's minds. And it's just this disconnect between the reality of the situation, which is that the market delivers 95% of the housing in this country. I mean, rightly or wrongly, like, sure, I wish there was more social housing, more public housing, but it's the market who delivers it. And so we kind of got to work with developers and realize the important role they're playing. What do you think?
Oh, I think, yeah, there's a reality of more housing however we get it and more housing in the right places. So I'm very bullish, and I got really angry the other day when someone suggested that all of these houses should be built out west somewhere. And I grew up out west. I'm very fortunate. I can live inner west and be close to transport and the city. And it's a very fortunate place to be. And I think also density enriches cities. So it's hugely beneficial to have high density, as long as it's supported by services and transport, of course. But the cities we love to visit and pay a lot of money to fly to have high densities. Like, that's the places we love to spend our holidays on, you know, in Europe, in terms of cities anyway. I mean, maybe if you're going to an island, a paradise, you want lower density. The places we spend a fortune traveling to our winter in Europe are places of high density.
And isn't it great when you go there, you can sort of just spend an afternoon strolling and stumble across great things because there is that density.
That's right. And if you need something, it's there.
Mm.
But also how you move around and how Sydney's the real revolution that's underpinning the housing revolution is the transport. It dawned on me a few years ago when I didn't feel like driving to Randwick, and I realized that I could get a bus into the city and then jump on a tram. It clicked. I was like, oh, yeah, the connection. Transport's about connection and a network. And I was like, okay, now I understand the tram system, because the tram system was this weird thing that took forever to build and no one liked it and all the businesses complained. And then it was really slow. But when I went to Randwick, it was the same at that time of day. It was the same amount of time to get a tram as it would have taken to be sitting in the car park that is the Eastern Distributor. So I was like, yeah, now I get it.
Yeah, public transport really makes sense when it's convenient. So the same for me this morning. I was in the office today. I'm here in Drummoyne, and it's faster for me. Well, Google Maps told me that it was faster for me to get the bus along Victoria Road into Sussex Park in the city than it would be to drive with the bus lane. So good.
Yeah, I love it.
You feel like you're VIP, actually, because you're just like cruising down your own lane. It's great. if you can feel VIP on public transport. I don't know, I do.
I really would prefer to catch a train. Maybe because it's still novelty, somewhat, because we don't have trains in Rozelle or Balmain, and so it's still a bit of a adventure. You find this interesting, Mel. I didn't realize that trains could go to different places. Like, I thought if you get on a train, there's a track. And so I got on a train and I ended up somewhere different. Didn't realize that trains from the same platform could end up in. So I got on a town hall and I asked the guy which platform I was getting a train to Parramatta. And I was like, what platform? He's like, platform. He said, platform two. Went to platform two, got on the train. And I'm like, hang on a minute. I'm in Erskineville. This train is lost. Yeah, of course. I'm an idiot, of course. Like, trains go to different places.
A few weeks ago, I was in New York and the subway is a whole different kettle of fish. That's just next level. And it took me a while to figure out which platform, because they've got multiple lines, multiple directions, all in the one station. It's like, it's a lot to get your head around.
And then, have you been to Tokyo?
I haven't.
Yeah. Oh, that's a whole different. Yeah, it's incredible.
Are they friendly?
Oh, yeah, everyone's friendly.
Locals?
They were to me.
Yeah, well.
Anyway, we really wanted to talk to you because you know more about planning than I do. It's still a little bit of a mystery as to what's changing. And we're talking specifically about rezoning, mass rezoning, upzoning, transport hub, the TODs, transport orientated development. It's all still a little bit of a black box. I think we're getting some insights, but there's still a lot of gaps, even in our architecture team who are in the thick of it somewhat. So I thought we'd speak to the expert. But first, I went to speak at a council meeting at Inner West Council because they were doing some particularly, would it be right to say, ambitious upzoning?
It would be right. Well, essentially, the TODs and the LMR from the state was imposed on that council as well, like all councils. And they went back and said, look, we want to do our own version. And that's what our Fairer Future plan is. And it certainly has the potential to deliver a lot more homes than what the state's rezoning would have.
Yeah, right. So they've gone further than what the state government mandated reform would do. And I think that part of the problem that people had with it is they thought that it was specifically focused on Dulwich Hill, Marrickville. So it was imbalanced. I'm thinking to myself, well, hang on, White Bay is still coming, right? White Bay is still under wraps somewhat. And White Bay, by White Bay, I mean the development happening in White Bay along the fringe of Rozelle, Balmain. No one really knows what's happening there. Or do you know anymore? What do you know, Mel?
As I understand, there's a bit of a hold up down there because of the port and trying to negotiate with the Port Authority who want to keep their operations there. That's where that's at, as far as I'm aware.
But both are state government authorities, right?
Yes, I guess they are. But that port is quite important to the overall operations for Sydney in general. It's a critical site, and that's why they can't just get rid of it. It needs to be like really well thought out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky enough to be able to walk past it every second day, and it does feel hugely underutilized. I mean, it's got some storage happening, and I think we want it to be a port. We just don't want it to be like a amusement park, which part of it should be a port, but there's still heaps of land there that's underutilized. So I guess it's finding the balance between leaving some of that port, relocating other parts of it. But back to planning, back to the Fairer Futures. As you know, I went to the council meeting. I went to speak. The room was packed. They were only letting people who registered to speak in. And I was supporting upzoning generally because I was really pissed off with what I experienced at a previous council meeting where really people were saying strange things about, well, development needs to happen in Badgerys Creek, send them to Badgerys Creek kind of thing, I'm like, no, it should happen in a burbs. It's the density is quite low, but on the world stage, in the denser inner west suburbs, the density is pretty low. It's high for Sydney because in other parts of Sydney, there's one person for every 10 square kilometers. Like, in, it's very different.
Yeah, like lowest density cities in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So being the highest in the lowest density city in the world doesn't make us high density. But I went in and I went to speak and I didn't realize that there were two sides of the room, and there was the NIMBY side, the anti-development side, and the IMBY side, the pro and the... So there were two halves to the room. And of course, I didn't know that. So I sat in the middle of all the NIMBYs, the people, the anti-developers. Some of them had placards with animals, and one lady had a rat with like greedy developer rat sort of thing, or rat, I can't remember, but it was, she put a bit of effort in. It was well done on a stick. So there were people with placards, and she's a lovely lady. She was very, very nice to me. But I realized that because I grabbed a seat late, I was literally like the head of the NIMBY crowd. And slowly it became apparent that I was sitting in the middle of the NIMBYs, the anti-development group. But I thought it was more awkward to move than it was to be there. And, you know, I made friends, people sitting next to me, and, you know, it was a good night. But then I had to apologize to them all, thought I was on their team, but I was actually on the other team. But they welcomed, and I sat back in my seat. They're like, don't worry, we can still be friends. So they were really like, but anyway, I was the head NIMBY until I realized I was in the wrong place. But it was interesting. And the most interesting thing from that night was how many people seemed like they stood up to speak against the development. And then you realize that actually their problem with it is that they're missing out on the up zone. They want to be part of the up zone. They're complaining about the 10-story apartment. But the thing that really irked them was the fact that they can't up zone their site. Sometimes it's unfortunate because it's a heritage boundary, right? A heritage conservation area boundary. And it seems very unfair to be one-sided boundaries rezoned. A lot of the people who spoke against were, we can't upzone. So that was really interesting. Tell us more about the Fair Futures and the details of it. What is it? And is it an outlier event where an upzone happens to the real disadvantage of a neighbor?
Well, look, nothing in life is fair. So I don't think we can expect anything to be perfect in terms of a city growing. There's always going to be imperfections as you have growing pains and things change. What I really respect and like about the Fairer Future Plan is that it was evidence-based and it was done using research from the very best of the industry. And that happened because the Inner West Council applied for and received a grant from the federal government. That gave them the resourcing to be able to engage great consultants and to go deep. And so that means that the planning controls were done based on feasibilities and what will actually stack up, which is important. And also that's why specific areas were chosen over other areas, as well as the desire of the council to preserve and protect, as you said, the heritage areas that provide Inner West with some of its character and I guess, yeah, heritage and history. So there was a lot of research done and very nuanced research into all the different areas and what makes Inner West Council great, and they wanted to amplify those aspects. So that does mean that in protecting some areas, if we still need homes, we still need density, it has to go somewhere. And that's why the plan kind of was the way it was. But the council did lots of consultation and they took lots of very detailed submissions. They went back to the consultants and said, look, I want you to run the feasibility again. Can we include this feedback? How can we amend the plan so that we can start to take on board the feedback? So I thought that was really great, and that we did see some changes to the plan throughout its development before it got passed on that front. So one of the most impressive things, I think it's quite a progressive plan, particularly in terms of the incentives that are built in for developers. And so they're progressive in the sense that they provide uplift where to reward developers where they do the right things. One of the examples is if the development that you're proposing goes above and beyond the sustainability base level requirements and they include really great other features, you can get an uplift in FSR and in height. So those sort of things, and all of those developer incentives are cumulative, so they can add up. So it can really make a real difference in terms of the development that we get and the density we get that's going to be high quality.
Yeah. And I guess at some point, if you're unlucky enough to be on the boundary of a heritage conservation area, is there any mitigation? Because that was one of the things that occurred to me. I'm like, oh my God, these people are on the boundary, that there's a rezone on the other side. And I took the guy's word for it, but it was, he said the back fence was the boundary of the heritage conservation area. So he effectively said behind them was a development, but they weren't allowed to develop because they're heritage conservation area. So is there any mitigation to that? Like, can you actually have a heritage conservation boundary with a major up zone? He was saying up to 10 stories adjacent.
I do believe that there was reviews done on transition zones. And I think that there was a reduction in some heights around certain areas to provide a softer transition. I know that there were changes made to the extent of those and across the whole Inner West Council. I don't know exactly, but I do know that that sort of feedback was taken on board and transition zones were included.
Yeah. And what about like if you've got that transition zone, but you've got a new rezone, does overshadowing still come into it as a factor or is it purely data driven? Is it more like CDC compliant development? What does that development look like? So if I've, as pretend I'm a developer, a greedy developer, as some would say, and
I don't want to hear that.
As I said in my presentation to council, there's no evidence that developers as a group of people are any more greedy than Marrickville socialists or anyone else. Like there's no evidence that suggests as a group they're any more greedy. So I use that as a point of jest, but say I am a developer and I've had that up zone, is there still other planning considerations or is it purely like a complying development where it's automated? What does that mean? What does that up zone look like?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the way it works is this plan will provide the high level controls, so the maximum you can achieve, but it will still be subject to the council's development guidelines and the other controls such as solar access and the like. And so when this plan comes in, should a developer or even a family, because let's remember, mums and dads and families are developers too, just trying to get ahead, they will still need to lodge an application to the statutory department inside Inner West Council and go through an assessment process, which will look at the development on its merits to make sure that impacts are mitigated or reduced or limited and amenities is maintained.
Yeah. And is any of the proposed legislation or rezone, well, Inner West or elsewhere, more like compliant development? Apart from, I guess, the pattern book is a little bit like that, but is there any automated?
Yeah, compliant development will still be possible as per the state's exempt and compliant development code. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So you can do compliant development in high, in 10-story apartments?
No, that code that the state has brought, that the state has, is not going to change. So you can only build according to that existing code. It might just open up a few more sites.
Yeah. So we've been talking about the bubble that we're in the Inner West, right? But what is the environment? I mean, we've heard about Woollahra train station, but what's happening in broader Sydney?
Well, I mean, Woolawarra is is an interesting one, isn't it? That was quite an exciting announcement, I thought, in terms of the state government really owning the rhetoric that they're coming out with and saying, yeah, we are going to increase housing in sought-after areas, established sought-after areas. And what better place than on a GO station, one that was built and never opened and developed on. So I think that's pretty exciting.
I didn't know about it, or maybe I knew once and I forgot, but I knew about the train that never made it to Bondi, but which is a Bondi Junction termination because people in Bondi didn't want the train because they thought it would bring outsiders into their suburb, which of course they came anyway from all over the world, but the train maybe slowed them down, maybe not. But I don't know. I don't catch the train in Bondi often enough, I guess. What else is happening?
Well, I mean, we've got the state's low to mid-rise code. It's been in force for a while now and it's starting to get uptake, which is great. So that means we're going to see a lot more what they call like gentle density right across our established areas, which is fantastic. So more people will be able to live in good places like the Northern Beaches or Mosman or North Sydney. So that's pretty exciting. And then we've also obviously got also the transit-oriented development as well, which again is all about similar to the LMR around increasing density around stations, which just makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So is that a foregone conclusion? And wherever there's a metro station, there's...
No, it should be. It should be that way. They've selected stations, but I think I did hear murmurs that the state government may announce more TOD stations, which would be good. I do personally believe that the LMR and the TOD do not go far enough in terms of upzoning to enable the level and amount of housing that we need.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess there is a bit of opposition. And I think part of it is understandable. People don't want change. There was a group of people from, I can't remember if it was Dulwich Hill, or I think it was Dulwich Hill, who were losing a car park to housing that was seemed very unjust to them, that car parks should be changed to housing. But apart from the change, I guess some people make a case that actually development increases prices. And I can see how that might happen because new cars on the road are more expensive than old cars because they're new. But I think in the broader sense, I think economics 101, supply and demand, applies. Is there any downside?
I think there is no downside to increasing supply ever. I think it's an absolute necessity for a city to provide enough housing for its current and future populations. We're not doing that right now as a city. And so I think it's vital that we do increase housing. And yes, we need to do it in a way that's sensitive to existing urban areas, but that shouldn't be a reason to stop it in terms of trying to maintain the current character. I don't know why it is that people in Australia think that cities need to remain and should remain as they are, and that we should, as you said, grow and build somewhere else. It's a strange mindset. It's like, here's what we have. If you're not in the city and there's not enough housing for you, too bad, you can't be in the city. Whereas overseas, it's sort of like, I don't know, there's more of a maturity of consciousness where it's like cities grow, they evolve, they change, new people come, they go through identities, and that progressive thought just doesn't seem to have taken hold in the Australian collective consciousness, I don't think.
Well, I think you nailed it when you said the word maturity. Like, we still think that a building that's built in the 1930s is so precious. I guess in the world scale of architecture and cities, we're going to visit friends in Switzerland in January, and they live in a farmhouse that was built I can't remember, I'm misquoting, but it was either 500 or 600 years ago. Like, it's substantially old. And so we're sort of thinking on a different scale just because we're worried and there's this worry about things changing. But I think it's a maturity thing.
Yeah, I agree. We're young as a country. And as you said, the heritage also. And I think what we're experiencing, when you said before, there's a lot of people concerned about the change. I think that's natural. It's human nature, isn't it, to be worried about change. But I think if we can flip our minds to embrace it and say, well, we're growing up. Our city, if we just take Sydney, we're growing up and we're becoming more mature. We've got a metro now. we should have sewn around it. And so I think what we're feeling is growing pains as we mature as an individual cities and as a nation as a whole.
And flipping it back to housing and affordability and actually the reality that I think some countries have sold better than others, but certainly in Australia, we're a long way behind other cities in the world, but we're also maybe ahead of others as well. But in terms of housing, I'm just wondering whether planning is enough. Like, it feels like in Balmain, where we are right now, there's one development that's moved forward. It took 20 years, the Balmain Tigers site, very controversial, very painful to see it empty for so long. But also another site just very much closer to us, which has stalled, which was a site just on Beattie Street, just literally over my shoulder. And I was like, finally, a multi-residential site in the heart of Balmain that is being built. And then it kind of stopped again. And look, I don't know the story. I mean, if you've got any goss, please share, but it's certainly not moving. There's occasionally someone walking around with a notebook, which isn't a good sign, but it feels like nothing. There's approval. There's approval to develop the building that I'm sitting in, right? Which is a row of shops with offices above. And it just feels improbable that it's going to stack up. So what else has to happen?
Yeah, look, you make a really good point. The thing is that there are many issues why we don't have enough homes. And you're right, planning is one factor. There's lots of other reasons, labor shortages, as you said, feasibility, construction costs, the like. The thing is that planning sits on top of all of that. So if there's not enough sites in a city zoned for development, you're essentially restricting that development funnel right at the top. And so there was a really good report done by Mecome Planning and the Committee for Sydney called Planning for Growth. And what that showed is to account for all of those developer realities in that funnel, such as the ones I mentioned and many others, the planning, the upzoning, it actually needs to be 7 times the target or the population need, which is pretty crazy because at the moment we upzone perfectly to match that target, the amount, the population. We need to do it actually 7 times more than that to be able to account for the funnel.
Yeah, right. And where does that data come from? Or how do they know it? Like, how do you work that out? I mean, that's...
Read the report. I'll send it to you.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. I wonder if they peg it to other cities around the world or what has happened, I'm presuming. But yeah, absolutely. It feels a lot like the cost to build apartments is a real killer. Someone asked me, why is it more cost effective to build 10-story apartments? And I said, I don't think it is per square meter, but I think there's a better return on the apartment, the penthouse on the 10th story. But I don't know, that's my hypothesis. I don't actually know the answer.
Two things that are coming to my mind. I'm not sure if they directly answer your question, but first of all, I think it's worth pointing out that the Productivity Commission did find that it's cheaper by $70,000 per dwelling, per home, to build infill rather than greenfield on the outskirts. So that, and I actually was speaking to the head of Sydney Water the other day, and she was saying how, and this is quite cool actually, because Sydney Siders have been so good over the past decade or so with their water conservation, that they have, instead of using 400 litres, no, must be not that, maybe, I can't remember, anyway, 400 litres per something, per person, we now use 200 litres per something per person. So we've halved the usage of the existing capacity, which means there's a lot more capacity. So for them to build on the outskirts, it's huge cost for them. So they also want to see the existing infrastructure in Sydney used for more development. So that's, I think, just worth mentioning. But one lever I think needs to be looked at, I'm not coming up with something new here, we've heard it for many years, but the other issue with the construction costs now or development costs is the number of charges from the government. There's so many different ones, and it's just like $100,000 per dwelling. So I think there needs to be some kind of reduction there, because that's where the government can pull a lever. They can't really do much about directly anyway, about like labor shortages or material costs. But reducing those, I think, would make more developments cost effective and therefore cheaper to build, and hopefully then hit the market cheaper as well.
Yeah, that's certainly, there's a layer of red tape being applied to multi-residential development that we get every day, because we do multi-res and apartment renovations are covered in the same layer as building a new apartment tower. So if someone wants to renovate their bathroom, they're covered by the same rules. And it's brutal, like it slows everything down and adds quite a layer of complexity to what should be a simple approval or maybe used to even be development. So yeah, that's certainly a factor. But yeah, in terms of feasibility, I feel like, yeah, feels contradictory. I think houses in the outer burbs, single story houses that per square meter are definitely cheaper to build than apartments. And apartments are expensive because they have fire systems and all sorts of planning restrictions. So that's the conundrum. The sugar hit is those houses out in the burbs. They're cheap. They get the building industry moving. You know, like I had a guy, Simon Croft from HIA. I mean, his answer to everything was more houses. It didn't matter. Like he said, I said, what about apartments versus just more houses? They just want more houses. So their view is just more houses anywhere you can get them. But I think there's a cost. You pay the piper down the track. But anyway, what's next? So what's next for the zoning? What is the next thing? So we talked about existing upzone, the transport-oriented development. Most of them are just rezone, but the old rules still apply in terms of getting a DA. Is that just to sort of round that out? Did I get that right?
For the transit-oriented development, that was actually quite significant in terms of the uplift. But just on the back of what we were saying is that a lot of them are not stacking up at the moment. A lot of sites in those TODs are not stacking up. So I really feel that...
That's financially for the developer, yeah.
What I think is, like, I think the TOD is clever and it's good urban planning 101. I think it's a long-term play in terms of delivering supply. Eventually it will stack up, but at the moment it's just not.
So my question was more like the TOD versus upzone, general upzone. Is the TOD a different approval pathway or is it?
No, yeah, no. It'll have to go through your local council.
Yeah, so it's still a DA. It's just that the state planning overrides the local planning laws.
Density, yeah. And that's the same with the LMR. That's the same with the low to medium rise policy. You still have to lodge a DA.
Yeah. So the DA system is still from our experience, the DA system can be quite predictable in terms of outcome sometimes or opposition from council, but time is the thing that the difference between compliant development and submitting to council is time.
And also more risk because there's too many people who object to it or the council choose that they don't want to approve it. Well, you're not getting an approval. With the LMR right now, what we're seeing is each council, like it's still finding its footing in terms of how the state controls overlap or mesh or dovetail into. Ideally, they'd dovetail, but they're not really at the moment. They're almost kind of combative, the controls. They're not neatly fitting in. And so each council is therefore interpreting the state policy in their own way. And that's at the moment, until the confusion settles down, it's still like each development, I'm recommending our clients to go and get a pre-DA to flesh out the issues early on. And because the other issue is that because it is being interpreted differently by each council and the council, we're not getting clear guidance from the State Department either about the intention of what they want or their guidance around interpreting their policy. That's really leaving it open to interpretation. And that's causing some confusion and delay. So to get clarity and to work with the council, I think until the issues are ironed out, pre-DAs are important as a risk mitigation strategy.
And are pre-DAs any different for major developments than they are for minor developments? Because, I mean, we don't do pre-DAs. They're a complete waste of time for smaller developments. You'll get a bum steer or you'll get false information that if you rely on occasionally someone else in council will say, well, that's not right and it's not binding in any way. Is it different when you have a major development?
It is, because there's more complexity. So it's good to unpack those. It's good to unpack those before you then commission all the other reports that would be required for a DA. So you consider just going with plans, a high-level planning assessment, and maybe if there are some critical issues identified up front, you might take a report in. But typically, you can then finalize the design after the pre-DA with that feedback from council, and then informs the rest of the reports after that.
And I guess if it's a pre-DA for a major development, is it a more senior planner that you speak to normally? Because I guess the pre-DA is the luck of the draw, and sometimes you get someone hugely knowledgeable, competent. Sometimes you don't get that, I found.
Yeah, the council want the right people in the room because they want to give you the right feedback. So like if there are, say, stormwater issues, they'll make sure that their stormwater engineer is there, which I think is good. And that's the way it should be, because you do need that clear direction. If you're there wanting to work with council, and it's good when they respect that and get the right people in the room.
So we've unpacked the low medium density. We've unpacked the TOS. What's next? I mean, we talked about White Bay, which is still a little bit of a black box that no one is opening at the moment. What else is on the cards, and what else is happening in planning in New South Wales?
Well, good questions. There are, I think what we're going to see is the metro is probably going to have a pretty big impact in terms of changing the face of Sydney. And as we see those more stations come online, I think I'm assuming and I'm hoping there'll be uplift associated with them.
Yeah. Uplift in density and.
Yeah. Yeah. Like one in my area, Five Dock. I think Five Dock really will be a great future center for Sydney. It'll be 10 minutes on the metro once that metro is built.
Yeah, absolutely. And then 10 minutes to Parramatta.
10 minutes to Parramatta, 10 minutes to the city. You've got beautiful, the bays, the harbour, the river runs right up there. It's just a beautiful place to live. So I think it would be great to see more people have a chance to live there. And that would be like a future center for Sydney.
Cool. And you were talking before about where state legislation conflicts with council legislation. That's a good lead in to tell people about a project you and I have been working on. I feel like I've been letting the team down recently a little bit, just been too busy setting up a new office and other things, but give us a Propinion update.
Propinion. Matt, that was such a genius name. Your brain, I admire it. Well, yeah, look, you and I started talking about this late last year about the fact that there's so much ambiguity in the planning system with all the different controls and legislation. And we as an industry are really left to put the pieces together. And we thought, why not do that rather than us sort of doing it ourselves together one-on-one, or maybe I know you've got a little group that you liaise with and I'd have the same. Why not bring that discussion that we're having behind the scenes with our colleagues, our industry peers? Why not have that discussion publicly so that we can all benefit as an industry? because everyone in the industry is having those discussions with their peers. And it's just about bringing that together in one place. And we, you and I talked about how we could best do that. And recently we settled on, to get the momentum, we settled on a LinkedIn group, which enables everyone in the industry who joins that group, which is a public open group, to go in and post any issue that they're having in terms of interpretation of the legislation. It's also a place where people can go and share updates if they have great insights on legislation changes to keep everyone up to date. And just where the, I guess, the industry can come together and debate different interpretations to provide more clarity for everyone.
How many of you are in the group now?
Well, it was invented and created a couple of weeks ago. So just 2 weeks, we now have 46 members.
Cool. All right. I was going to say to the 10 people who listen to the podcast, but there are actually a number of planning and property professionals that do listen to a lot of these podcasts. And certainly, what do they need to do?
Well, just go on to the Propinion community and just join. And then you'll get a welcome note, which very clearly and very concisely just outlines the rules of the group. Like, we want everyone to be respectful and helpful, and also that there is no liability in terms of, like, this is not legal advice. Yeah, it's not legal advice. It's just the community, the group coming together, having a chat. So you wouldn't go and like use it in any legal case or the like. And yeah, it's buzzing at the moment. There's already some people in there posting questions around calculating GFA. And what's been great is we've had different people come in and post their experiences or their knowledge and referencing case law, which is really helpful. We've had people posting about retaining walls and making sure that they're done according to legislation and just pointers around that, which has been helpful. But 100% encouraged everyone to get in there because it's everyone's voice that makes it valuable.
Yeah. And I've got to jump in and comment, and I've got some work to do there, but I am going to share it with all my contacts in property, and we're working on a plan to roll that out. And one interesting aspect of that, I don't know if you remember, we had a meeting with terrible names, but we had a meeting with a guy who was in planning or in property or development, and he pointed out the fact that if you have an expert opinion, you can rely on that as a defense in some, or misrepresenting, but you can use that as a defense, not a criminal matter, but certainly in a matter where you've relied on that professionally and it's a professional indemnity matter. So there is actually a value created when a group of experts come to a consensus. If you share that consensus, certainly that's a defense against malpractice or other things, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Did I mess that up? Did I mangle that? And I forgot the guy's name and I'm so sorry.
No, you've hit it at the nail on the head. Yeah, that's right. There is, in the Civil Liability Act, there is a clause there about the standard of care for professionals, and that one professional opinion, if you have concurrence in the industry, you can use that. That's right. It actually says that you've gone and done due diligence. And so what councils often do is if they are looking at a development and assessing it, and that there may be some, the assessing officer is maybe unsure, there's an ambiguity, which there always are, they can then go to other planners within the council and pose the issue to them and get their interpretation. And then they will often, that's how they reach a conclusion. And then they will often attach that email trail to the file so that that conclusion is, and how they got there, is on file.
And is Propinion relevant to council as well? Like, can people from council collaborate?
Totally.
Will they?
Well, that's a different question. We've already had quite a few local council office planners come in and join the community, which is awesome. I'm actually really excited about that. And definitely, that I think the more that professionals on both sides can come together to help each other, it just is makes life so much easier.
Absolutely. And who particularly do we want to promote the group to?
Everybody in the industry. every property professional.
So builders?
Builders, certifiers, surveyors, architects.
Sounds like everyone that I'm connected to on LinkedIn.
Good. We'll get in there and share it. Yeah.
We'll get in there and share it. And so we'll start messaging people to join and letting them know about it. So I've got a bit of a backlog of work, but
I know
we'll get there.
But I mean, you personally, Matt, would be a great contributor in the group because you just have so much knowledge and expertise, and you've been doing this a long time. So yeah, it'd be great to see some of your comments in there as well.
I'm in. I'm commenting.
I've done the hard sell now.
That's probably a good place to wrap up. We've discussed planning law. We've discussed what's next. We've discussed Propinion. Yeah, thanks for joining me. What have you got on for the rest of the year? What's happening?
I'm really excited because next month I will be taking my planning team to Cambodia to see some schools that we've been supporting to build over there.
Cool. You've got a not-for-profit or what's, tell us more.
Yeah, exactly. So it is a not-for-profit. I sit on the board of Hark Angel, and that was founded by Richie Harkham, and his vision was to build 100 schools in the poorest places in the world. So the organization is up to school number 12. I've been on the board for a couple of years now, and I've just launched a corporate sponsorship program for corporates to donate and be part of the organization. And as part of that, when you raise a certain amount, you can take your team or select a few people from your team to go over there and see the school that you've contributed to.
Cool. And the school, so the school's built and functioning, or it's still being built? It's a proper school? Wow. Do you get to teach? Do you get to like teach English or just can you?
Well, it's a 6-day, this will be a 6-day trip for us. And there is a pretty big itinerary that the charity puts together. So you do get to go in and meet the teachers, meet the kids, which is pretty exciting, and see the school. So I'm actually also taking my 10-year-old son.
Cool. Cool, cool.
So yeah, Cambodia was a place that I went to when I was 18. And for me, it was one of my first places that I went to overseas. So it was very eye-opening in terms of, I mean, we're so sheltered here in Australia in terms of social injustice and poverty. And over there, it's certainly the opposite. And so seeing that, you know, firsthand really impacted me. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to join Richie's charity, Hark Angel, to be able to give back. And yeah, I'm excited to show my son too, because I think at 18 was when I first went there and first had my eyes opened. I think it certainly impacted me and had a positive impact on me wanting to make a difference in the world. And I hope that, I'm sure that my boy will also feel driven in that way as well once he sees it firsthand.
I mean, I love Cambodia. I traveled there. I cycled from one end to the other when I was 25. And what I cycled into Cambodia on New Year's Day, Khmer New Year, and it was just the biggest party I've ever been, the most drunk I've ever been, that I was escorted to the nearest Wat, which is the local temple. So that was my first couple of hours in Cambodia. I was bailed up and escorted to the nearest Wat. I was on my bike. They were motorbikes and escorted me. I was the guest of honor, and it was the wildest party in a religious setting I've ever experienced. There was dancing. There was a monk who was DJing. It was incredible. And the hangover, oh my God. Oh my God. But that was just the first few hours.
Wow. Well, the hangover sounds like it was worth it. That's pretty.
Oh, look, it was amazing. Everyone was dancing in this Wat. And yeah, the monks were running the party. And it was just but on a sad note, like I celebrated a birthday there a week or two later. And I realized that my birthday was, well, I was 1975. That's when the Khmer Rouge took over. There was no one else in Cambodia who was my age. That generation did not survive. So there was no babies born in Cambodia in the year that I was born. So had I been there, I wouldn't have survived. So it's had incredible upheaval. It has had a whole generation wiped out because there was a gap. There were old people and there were young people. my generation was missing. So I celebrated a birthday that was quite bittersweet because it was like, I'm one of the few people who was born in that year today.
Really makes it hit home hard.
Oh my God. And of course, then we ate happy pizza and had a good night. But yeah, it was quite confronting to be in a place where that was the year that no one survived. So brutal, but beautiful place.
Well, this trip will be confronting, but also there will be a lot of beauty there too. So it's just, I guess, life, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we've gone down some rabbit holes. Thank you so much.
I've gone philosophical.
Neighbor from Sky Planning, thank you so much. Really appreciated the chat and hope to have you again soon.
Yeah, awesome, Matt. Always a pleasure to be here and thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Buildapedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildapedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.